This is Audible.
William Morrow and Harper Audio present How to Be Fine. What we learned from living by the rules of 50 self-help books by Jolenta Greenberg and Kristen Meinzer. This is Jolenta Greenberg. For our listeners.
And our husbands. I don't like to give advice. I like to give people information, because everyone's life is different and everyone's journey is different. Dolly Parton. Hey, this is Kristen, half of the writing team of this book, and we're going to be alternating back and forth between chapters, so don't worry, you'll be hearing plenty from Jolenta as well as me. Introduction. Halfway through day two, I was crying because I ate two pickle slices and a leaf of lettuce. I knew I was cheating, and I felt horrible about myself. According to the rules of the book I was living by, I was supposed to consume only boiled leeks or the water that came off of boiled leeks, and I was failing. This was all happening just a week after I threw out half my earthly possessions and 3 weeks after I moved traffic with my mind. I was living by a diet book called French Women Don't Get Fat. The week before, I was living by the life-changing magic of tidying up. 3 weeks earlier, I was living by The Secret. This was my life. Every 2 weeks, I lived by a different self-help book, following all the rules down to the letter. Eating what the book said to eat. Talking as the book said to talk. Waking, sleeping, decorating, and interacting with my husband according to each book's doctrine. And I was recording it all for a reality show podcast called By the Book. The person who roped me into this life was my brilliant and hilarious friend Jolenta Greenberg. Jolenta is a comedian, storyteller, voice actor, teacher, and self-help enthusiast. She is a woman who loves crystals and talks earnestly about chakras and truly wants to believe the promises that self-help books routinely shill. The reason she asked me to co-host By the Book with her was that my views were exactly the opposite. I thought it would be good for a laugh. We would have fun. We would be ridiculous. We would make an entertaining show. Little did I know that all these books would actually change my life, sometimes even for the better. If not for By the Book, I never would have penned that Amish romance novel I'd always joked about writing. I never would have traveled back to my past lives, and I'm not sure I would have had some of the difficult conversations I've had with my husband about our marriage. By the Book started off as a wacky experiment, but over the course of its life, it's come to be something much bigger, and not just for us. We have a Facebook community of more than 15,000 people from around the world who talk with one another every day about topics that range from workplace drama to alcohol abuse. We've headlined events for the likes of the New York Times and given interviews to NPR, the BBC, the CBC, and even RNZ. That's Radio New Zealand. And we've been written up by The Guardian, The Washington Post, Time, Bust, BuzzFeed, IndieWire, and The Librarians of Lawrence, Kansas. But despite all our appearances, interviews, episodes, and Facebook community, listeners still want to know more. Why don't you two write a self-help book sharing what you've learned from living by all these books, we're often asked. And so, we've written this book. Obviously, we hope it satisfies our existing audience. But our dream is that it also speaks to people who've never heard of us. People who just want to know what two very honest women have to say about how their lives have been upended and improved by methodically following the advice of 50 self-help books in 3 years. Note, our goal is not to tell you how to live your lives. In the grand scheme of things, we're not what you would call experts. We're not psychologists or doctors, and we honestly don't believe we know more than you do about how to be the best version of yourself. As Jolenta often says, only you are an expert in you. We're really just here to share our story and to talk about what's worked for us and what hasn't. And for what it's worth, those things don't include mushy missives like empower your heart. Yes, mush can be inspiring and fun, but it also can be hard to actually put into practice. Thus, we'll be talking only about concrete steps we've taken. That means things you can try at home if that's really and truly what you want to do. But if you just want to laugh or shake your head as we recount how we've tortured ourselves in the name of betterment, that's also fine by us. You do you, and we'll do us. And now, This is what you should know about Jolenta. Jolenta, over to you.
Thanks, Kristen. When I was a tender, mouth-breathing five-year-old, I started kindergarten. On my first day, I brought with me a box of tissues. Each kindergartner was tasked with bringing in a box of tissues on the first day, and the boxes were supposed to live in our cubbies and be at our disposal for all our snot needs throughout the year. Come pickup time on my first day, my mother and my kindergarten teacher, Mrs. Marshall, watched in confusion as my tiny hands struggled to jam my tissue box back in my little neon pink backpack. I was clearly planning on taking my tissues home, while all around me, my classmates were leaving their tissues in their cubbies without giving them a second thought. "You can leave those in your cubby," Mrs. Marshall explained. "They'll be safe here and waiting for you every day." "Yeah, right," I thought. "I'm not going to leave my stuff in a strange room all night, not on my watch." I kept packing up and responded with a meek, "I'm okay," as I zipped up my bag and indicated I was ready to hit the road by pulling on my mom's coat. Mrs. Marshall and my mom exchanged amused glances and, through muffled laughter, concluded that I'd leave my tissues at school once I felt ready. This ritual continued every day. Every morning, I'd unpack my tissue box, lovingly leaving it in my cubby, and every afternoon, I'd pack my tissues up and take them home for the night, while my mom and teacher chuckled and reminded me I was free to leave them at school permanently when I was ready. And boom, one day after 2 weeks, it happened. I was ready. I had sussed out the situation, figured out the rules for myself, and decided it was finally time to trust in the system. This is one of my mom's favorite stories about me, because it perfectly encapsulates my idiosyncrasies. I'm always 2 weeks behind. I'm always catching up on life. I'm always just a few beats behind all of life's prescribed normal milestones, getting to them a bit later than everyone else. Whether it's getting comfortable leaving my tissues at school, having my first kiss, falling in love, getting a real job, I'm always running behind. My proclivity for being 2 weeks behind in life has followed me for the past 30-odd years, and it's why I became obsessed with self-help. During my teenage years, I discovered that tons of people have written all sorts of rule books about how to live. I knew if I could read them all and implement all their rules, I could catch up to everyone else and finally stop worrying about being behind in life. As an adult, I dabbled in self-help, reading the occasional book and watching the occasional inspirational internet video. But when one of my four part-time jobs landed me in a newsroom at a radio station, things got real. I was in charge of going through all the books sent to the show I worked on, and we got sent many self-help books that no one wanted, except me. I wanted them all. Each new self-help book I'd open was a beautifully bound bundle of promises of happiness, productivity, success, all things I desperately wanted. Each book I opened was basically saying, "Come on, Jolenta, I'll fix you. You don't want to be 2 weeks behind forever, do you?" No, I did not. So I took all the books, called my friend and coworker Kristen, and told her we were going to start a project for which we'd strictly live by the rules of the different self-help books I'd been collecting. Kristen is the kind of friend who is so on top of her life that it's infuriating. She's the anti-me. She's the friend you go to when you need advice on all things adult, whether you have questions about real estate lawyers or how to deal with estranged family members. Kristen has your answer. She doesn't need fixing like me, and that's why I knew she'd be my perfect self-help partner. She'd keep me accountable and serve as a sort of control group since she was the one who wasn't perpetually trying to catch up. If the books could enhance both of our lives, they worked for real. And that's how our podcast, By the Book, was born. Timing, work friendships, and a lifetime of being 2 weeks behind all came together to create an experiment in living by the rules of self-help books for, you guessed it, 2 weeks at a time. Kristen, back to you.
Thanks, Jolenta. Okay, the thing about me. Jolenta sometimes refers to me as the last person on earth who needs self-help books. I am, for the most part, a happy person. I don't spend a lot of time being anxious or thinking I'm a loser. I have resting jolly face. On top of that, Jolenta thinks I'm good at adulting. I've been working full-time since high school and paid my own way through college. I have a 401k, an accountant, and a real estate attorney. I go to the doctor when I need to, and I buy toilet paper before I run out. This isn't to say I'm a perfect specimen of what a human can or should be. Far from it. I always have large piles of paper laying around, and I rarely clean or cook for myself. My beloved husband Dean does those things. Like most Americans, I could probably stand for less screen time and fewer Cheetos. Even though it might be good for me, I don't look at myself in the mirror every single day and exclaim, "What a gorgeous lady." And I've had my fair share of problems over the years. I went to 7 schools growing up, many of which counted me as the only non-white person in my class. I was abused by my father and stepmother so seriously that they lost their rights to see me when I was 12. I battled disordered eating beginning in grade school and well into my 20s. In college, I dated more than one guy who called me names, stole my money, or wouldn't be seen in public with me. I've been sexually harassed by bosses, and I held both my mother and my grandmother in my arms as they died. Despite all this, I know I'm lucky. A lot of people go through all I have and much, much worse, but without good friends. Plenty of people have brains that are wired to process trauma in a, well, more traumatic way than my brain does. Lots of folks have bodies that don't work the way they want them to, while I do. And far too many people don't feel empowered to, or can't afford to, seek help from mental health professionals. I've seen plenty over the years. But the truth is, I still get down sometimes. I think this is natural. I think our lives are filled with ebbs and flows. Sometimes we wake up feeling fabulous. Sometimes, later that same day, we feel ornery. Sometimes there's something deep inside of us that doesn't feel quite satisfied. I'm guessing that's why there are so many self-help books in the world. If people felt content all the time, there wouldn't be any need for them. That being said, I've always looked upon self-help books with suspicion. A lot of them seem to prey on people's insecurities, and the covers often make promises that are impossible for any one volume to deliver on. The one guaranteed way to change your life, the number one way to make more money in the next year, the only proven method for getting your child to sleep. Of course, this is why Jolenta and I make such a good team. For all the hope she brings to self-help books, I bring a dose of skepticism. And for every promise she wants to believe, there's a promise I want to shoot holes in. Also, I have a background as a critic. All through college, I was an arts and entertainment critic. For years, I worked in a university office where the main purpose was to deconstruct media. And shortly before co-creating By the Book, I wrapped a 6-year gig co-hosting a film review podcast. But to be clear, I don't just play the role of a critic when Jolenta and I live by self-help books. Hardly. At this point in the game, I think it's safe to say that I've cried just as much as she has on the show, if not more. I've shared way more than I initially wanted to, and I've willingly opened my personal life up to loads of criticism. And did I mention that I've learned a thing or two? In some cases, I've just had my suspicions confirmed. In others, I've actually felt my life improve. Some of this improvement stems from my friendship with Jolenta growing and evolving through our show. I'm incredibly grateful for her. Some of this improvement comes from sharing my stories with people who may truly benefit from them. And some of it, yes, I'll admit, comes from living by these ridiculous books. All right, enough of my backstory. Let's get to how these books have enhanced and destroyed my life and Jolenta's.
The full list of books we've lived by in order so far.
The Secret by Rhonda Byrne.
The Life-Changing Magic of Tidying Up, The Japanese Art of Decluttering and Organizing by Marie Kondo.
So organized.
Mm-hmm.
French Women Don't Get Fat, The Secret of Eating for Pleasure by Marie Giuliano.
Is eating for pleasure a secret? The Memory Book, The Classic Guide to Improving Your Memory at Work, at School, and at Play by Harry Lorraine and Jerry Lucas.
I don't remember that book.
Mm-mm.
Past Lives, Future Healing. A Psychic Reveals the Secrets to Good Health and Great Relationships by Sylvia Brown.
America's Cheapest Family gets you right on the money. Your Guide to Living Better, Spending Less, and Cashing in on Your Dreams by Steve Economides and Annette Economides. And no, they did not change their names to match their jobs.
Men Are from Mars, Women Are from Venus. The Classic Guide to Understanding the Opposite Sex by John Gray.
Class with the Countess, How to Live with Elegance and Flair by Luann de Lesseps of Real Housewives fame.
How to Write an Ebook in Less Than 7 to 14 Days That Will Make You Money Forever by Darren Ackers. Yes, forever.
Bored and Brilliant, how spacing out can unlock your most productive and creative self by Manoush Zomorodi.
The Little Book of Hygge, Danish Secrets to Happy Living by Mike Viking.
Why Good Things Happen to Good People, how to live a longer, healthier, happier life by the simple act of giving by Stephen G. Post and Jill Nymark.
The Miracle Morning, the not-so-obvious secret guaranteed to transform your life.
Before 8 a.m.
by Hal Elrod.
What to Say When You Talk to Yourself by Shad Helmstetter.
I say, you're awesome. Or hold on, I say, I'm awesome. The Five Love Languages, The Secret to Love That Lasts by Gary Chapman.
The Wild Unknown Tarot Deck and Guidebook by Kim Krantz.
The Subtle Art of Not Giving an F, or Is It a Fuck? A Counterintuitive Approach to Living a Good Life by Mark Manson.
You Are a Badass, How to Stop Doubting Your Greatness and Start Living an Awesome Life by Jen Sincero.
I think we're doing that right now. Meditation for Fidgety Skeptics, a 10% Happier How-To Book by Dan Harris and Jeff Warren with Carly Adler.
Zero Waste Home, The Ultimate Guide to Simplifying Your Life by Reducing Your Waste by Bea Johnson.
Presence, Bringing Your Boldest Self to Your Biggest Challenges by Amy Cuddy.
The Nature Fix, Why Nature Makes Us Happier, Healthier, and More Creative by Florence Williams.
A Girl's Guide to Joining the Resistance, A Feminist Handbook on Fighting for Good by Emma Gray.
The 4-Hour Workweek, Escape 9-to-5, Live Anywhere, and Join the New Rich by Timothy Ferris. What if you want to join the old rich?
The Curated Closet, A Simple System for Discovering Your Personal Style and Building Your Dream Wardrobe by Anne Ushka Reese.
How to Apologize by the Greater Good Science Center at UC Berkeley.
Girl, Wash Your Face. Stop Believing the Lies About Who You Are So You Can Become Who You Were Meant to Be by Rachel Hollis.
A Simple Act of Gratitude, How Learning to Say Thank You Changed My Life by John Kralik.
Thank you. Year of Yes, How to Dance It Out, Stand in the Sun, and Be Your Own Person by Shonda Rhimes.
I'll do anything Shonda tells me to do. Pick 3, You Can Have It All.
Just Not Every Day
by Randy Zuckerberg.
Pence Drunk, The Finnish Path to Relaxation by Miska Rantanen.
Big Magic, Creative Living Beyond Fear by Elizabeth Gilbert.
Astrology for Happiness and Success from Aries to Pisces. Create the Life You Want Based on Your Astrological Sign by Mecca Woods.
The Four Agreements, A Practical Guide to Personal Freedom by Don Miguel Ruiz.
The 9 Steps to Financial Freedom, Practical and Spiritual Steps So You Can Stop Worrying by Susie Orman.
The Body Is Not an Apology, The Power of Radical Self-Love by Sonia Renee Taylor.
How to Hold a Grudge, From Resentment to Contentment, The Power of Grudges to Transform Your Life by Sophie Hanna.
The Sleep Revolution, Transforming Your Life One Night at a Time by Arianna Huffington.
Getting Things Done, The Art of Stress-Free Productivity by David Allen.
Next Level Basic, The Definitive Basic Bitch Handbook by Stassi Schroeder from Vanderpump Rules.
The Art of Dying Well, A Practical Guide to a Good End of Life by Katie Butler.
That book will kill you. So you want to start a podcast, finding your voice, telling your story, and building a community that will listen by my friend, Kristen Meinzer.
That's me.
Yay.
How to Win Friends and Influence People by Dale Carnegie.
On Being a Real Person by Harry Emerson Fosdick. What About Fake People?
The Power of Positive Thinking by Norman Vincent Peale.
Phyllis Diller's Housekeeping Hints by Phyllis Diller.
The Joy of Sex, A Gourmet Guide to Lovemaking by Alex Comfort.
That's his porn name. The Dance of Anger, A Woman's Guide to Changing the Patterns of Intimate Relationships by Harriet Lerner.
Who Moved My Cheese? An Amazing Way to Deal with Change in Your Work and in Your Life by Spencer Johnson.
The Gifts of Imperfection, Let Go of Who You Think You're Supposed to Be and Embrace Who You Are by Brené Brown.
For your convenience, we've included this list as a downloadable PDF available from your audiobook provider or go to www.harpercollins.com/audio/how-to-be-fine. Part 1, 13 Things That Worked. Commit Acts of Kindness. Friends, I feel it would be totally disingenuous if I didn't come right out and admit it. I love being nice. I love giving compliments to friends and strangers. I adore starting off each day by yelling a jolly good morning to an office full of coworkers. Giving up my seat on the subway for a person who might need it is one of my favorite things. Being nice is the best! And so, it should come as no surprise that it was my idea to live by Why Good Things Happen to Good People, a 10-step guide to kindness and happiness by Jill Nymark and Stephen G. Post. Full disclosure, Jill Lenta hated this book. She found it cheesy, occasionally dated, and narrow in its scope. And yes, I'll agree that the book has its faults. That being said, when we lived by it, even Jill Lenta admitted that it gave her a taste of what it must feel like to be one of the happy people. And it's not the only book to do this. A Girl's Guide to Joining the Resistance by Emma Gray and Zero Waste Home by Bea Johnson are just two more that did the same thing. In fact, every time we've lived by a book that encourages us to commit acts of kindness and altruism, we both felt better. And not just because being a goody-two-shoes gives us an excuse to feel self-righteous about being better citizens or wins us the admiration of strangers. Kindness just feels good. We've seen this with the people in our immediate lives, our husbands, our friends, our coworkers. For example, while we were living by good things, I was promoted to a managerial position. I thought about all the times new managers had come into my life over the years and taken over without checking in with the existing staff and asking what they needed. I wanted to do things differently. And so I embarked on my new position by having one-on-one meetings with every person on my team. I asked what issues they felt needed the most attention, where they felt unsupported, and what they liked and didn't like about how things currently stood. Of course, I wasn't able to fix all the things that needed fixing in my department, but this listening tour made me feel more connected with my team. For both Jill Lenta and me, kindness also created a greater sense of connection with people we didn't know. For example, in looking for people to help in her day-to-day life, Jill Lenta noticed all the women carrying their strollers with their babies still in them up and down the often treacherous New York City subway stairs. And every chance she got, she helped them. She put herself in the shoes of those mothers and did a tiny bit of labor for them. Those little acts of kindness made it impossible for her not to feel more connected with her fellow humans. This isn't to say that Jill Lenta had never noticed these women before or offered to help them. She had, but it wasn't something she deliberately set out to do each day, and when she did, she felt happier. To our tremendous relief, we also found that doing the right thing helped empower us in the face of past traumas. Specifically, Jill Lenta and I both decided while living by Why Good Things Happen to Good People to speak up about how we'd been mistreated by men in power. She spoke up by performing a stand-up set pillorying a former boss who'd hit on her. I spoke up by reaching out to the president of my prior workplace, reporting the host of a show who had sexually harassed me. Coincidentally, not long after we spoke up, an investigative reporter named Suki Kim reached out to both of us, asking us to share our stories. She had a much larger platform than either of us did, which meant our acts of decency, kindness, bravery, or whatever you want to call them, would help more people than either of us could on our own. Her story made international headlines and became one of the pivotal writings on the Me Too movement in 2017. But whether our actions attract international headlines or no attention at all, we know we're making ourselves feel happier when we're kind. For example, when I feel down, helping strangers carry their groceries or shovel their cars out of snow piles elevates my spirits. When I'm not feeling great about myself, complimenting friends and strangers gives my mood a boost. Fun fact, I found this also works when I deliver the compliments behind people's backs, or positively gossip, as some people call it. And when we're feeling misunderstood, trying our best with kindness and humor to build bridges, as Jill Lenta attempted with her mother-in-law while living by one book, can make our hearts feel lighter and our relationships less strained. For me, there's probably no greater wellness practice than waking up each day and thinking, what can I do to make someone else's life a little better today? And then making sure, through my words and actions, to turn that one person into 2 or 5 or 10. Invariably, one of the people whose day is most improved will be me. And I can't say it enough. Being kind is fun. Just observe a group of small children playing, taking turns being banker, pushing each other on swings, and playing fair. Looking at them and their joy Who wouldn't prefer to be kind? It's way more fun than being mean.
Engage in positive self-talk. I've said it before and I'll say it again. When you have social anxiety, you eat and drink a lot of things you don't want to consume. The thought of possibly offending someone or being rejected is so nerve-wracking that rather than sending food back or saying you don't like something, you suck it up and pretend everything is fine. So if I'm at my in-laws and allergic to the main dish at dinner, I'll try to secretly load up on sides while strategically putting bits of the food I can't eat onto my husband's plate so it looks like I'm all good. Or if I'm at a bar and order a margarita but get served a gin and tonic, I'll drink that gin even though I don't like it. Sorry, gin lovers, I had a bad experience with it back in the day. Why do I do this? I have social anxiety, which means my mind is plagued by a constant rotating carousel of thoughts, worries, and heightened fears about how others are perceiving me. So I might think things like, if my in-laws see me not eating, they'll think I'm a rude, spoiled bitch and they won't love me anymore, and then they'll tell my husband not to love me. Or I'll have this thought running through my brain. Don't send this drink back. The bartender doesn't care if you hate gin. Don't make this her problem. She's super busy tonight, and if you add your complaint to her life, you're making her job harder and basically not supporting women. This extreme fear of social rejection means I end up eating and drinking things I don't want or don't like all the time. It's embarrassing but true. I'm used to carrying around this fear of social situations and the tape of self-deprecating thoughts that runs through my head to scold me into avoiding any kind of rejection. I've had this tape my whole life, hence my calling it a tape, because I was born in the 80s when we actually used tapes. It's kind of like having a really mean friend in your brain at all times, a friend who says things like this: you're a mess. She thinks you're an idiot. You're not doing enough. He thinks you're ugly. You're going to show up to this party at the wrong time. You're too much for people. You're a bad friend. And so on. I thought this harsh inner monologue was an immutable part of me. But a book called What to Say When You Talk to Yourself by Shad Helmstetter says it's possible to retrain that mean friend voice to start saying some nicer things. According to the book, which we live by during season 2 of By the Book, this kind of inner berating is called negative self-talk. And self-talk gets more negative over time because from the moment we're born, we're bombarded with messages about what we can and can't do. These messages come from every direction, from our parents, peers, teachers, social media, television, and society at large. We absorb these messages and use them to create the story of who we are. As we go through life, we collect the observations, values, and judgments of others. We take these stances on as though they are reality, because we're little babes simply trying to figure out the ways of the world and don't know any better. Each outside opinion we take on as truth is like a pair of tinted glasses we glue to our faces. Over time, we put on all sorts of colored glasses, each one tinted with a different rule about life. One tint tells you who is smart and who is dumb. Another tells you what your body should look like. Another tint constantly reminds you to say sorry for taking up as much space as the dude next to you. The list goes on and on. We take on so many of these beliefs that we end up walking around with hundreds of pairs of tinted glasses glued to our sweet, shining faces, and all the colors meld into dark, impenetrable blinders. We lose sight of ourselves and instead see a list of inadequacies that we're always aiming to fix. This is negative self-talk. Here is some of the negative self-talk I often say. Your body is repulsive. A man will never be attracted to you, and you need a man's approval to succeed in the world. You're too negative. Curly brown hair is not pretty. Your features are too Jewish. You're too tall to find love because guys want to be with only dainty, mousy, super feminine women. Your emotions are too big. You're irrational, and people see you as annoying and crazy. You suck at math. I often think of these things as facts, but they're really just someone else's biased opinions, not immutable truths. In fact, I can list every person I heard these annoying opinions from. See? Your body is repulsive, a man will never be attracted to you, and you need a man's approval to succeed in the world? My asshat high school health and PE teacher. You're too negative. My husband, from back when we first started dating. Curly brown hair is not pretty. The third grade recess attendant who commented one day that my friend with straight blonde hair was the most adorable. Your features are too Jewish, the non-Jewish side of my family. You're too tall to find love because guys want to be with only dainty, mousy, super feminine women. The dude I was boning when I first moved to New York, who said he was a feminist philosopher but wanted to seriously date only women who never challenged anything he said. Your emotions are too big. You're irrational and people see you as annoying and crazy. My mom, because she said the same things about herself when she had emotional reactions. You suck at math. Whoever decided that I randomly belonged in the lower level math class when I started middle school. Side note, most of the girls in my grade were put in that level without our parents being told. From living by what to say when you talk to yourself, I learned that we hear negative messages. Stop kicking that. Don't raise your voice. You can't go in there. And so on. More often than positive ones. And they tend to be more specific, too. And a lot of the time, we need those messages. I probably wouldn't be alive if I hadn't been taught, never touch that electrical socket, or stop flipping the bird every time a driver cuts you off. So I'm very glad these restrictive messages have stuck in my head and kept me safe. There's a problem with this system of message storage, though. Not all negative messages save our lives. Some are just dumb opinions and don't need to be stored as rules in our little baby brains, but they get stored away nonetheless. So things like, your hair is too curly to be considered pretty, or boys can't play with pink things like that, end up holding the same weight as their life-prolonging counterparts. As I've grown and matured, I've collected, filed, and set in stone many of these admonishing rules. They run my life at this point. They keep me on time. They keep me from walking into traffic. They even remind me to pee after sex so I don't get a UTI. But they also torture me with stupid rules based on shame, bias, or misinformation. Things like, oh, you know, I guess everything listed a few paragraphs earlier. These internal scolding messages feel like rules I have to live by that make my life harder, but they aren't rules. They're just things I say to myself that I heard from unreliable sources. So how do we get our self-talk to be kinder? How do we sort through all the rules we've learned about life, weed out the unhelpful ones, and start taking on kind tints that complement one another and together make a rosier outlook so we can enjoy life more? Helmstetter says that it's possible to reprogram our thought patterns and undo all that negative self-talk with some new positive messages. When we live by what to say when you talk to yourself, Kristen and I tried many ways to reprogram our thoughts to be more positive. This was pretty easy for Kristen. She already consciously tries to say nice things to herself. But you should know this wasn't always the case. It took her years to become as good at this as she is. Not unlike many girls growing up, she spent years feeling horrible about her body and putting herself down both out loud and in her head. But over time and with lots of work, she slowly started accepting compliments, saying nice things about herself, and eventually believing all these kind words. I, on the other hand, had never given much thought to what I say to myself until we lived by this book. But after I had tracked how I talked to myself for a day, it became clear I had a self-talk problem. Over the course of 24 hours, I didn't say one positive thing about myself or to myself. This was heartbreaking. I would never hang out with someone who talked to me the way I talked to me, and I became determined to change this. So I dove head first into the book's different self-talk exercises. Over 2 weeks, I had kind conversations out loud with myself in the shower, wrote kind mantras over and over in a journal, and listened to affirmation podcasts. And the whole time, it felt incredibly stupid to have conversations with myself while I washed my hair, and getting caught by my partner listening to recorded affirmations while I was cooking was profoundly embarrassing. Every time I said something complimentary to myself or about myself, I felt like a ridiculous fraud who dealt in lies and counterfeit. At the end of living by what to say when you talk to yourself, I wasn't sure I was doing it right. Forcing positive self-talk wasn't feeling natural, and I worried that maybe I was too broken or anxious for the book's advice to work. But then something surprising happened. The night we finished living by that book, I was served a very flat glass of Prosecco while at a bar in Brooklyn celebrating a friend's birthday. Since Prosecco is my go-to drink and my overblown fear of social ridicule means I never send anything back, I drink my fair share of flat Prosecco. But that night, without even thinking twice, I just strutted up to the bar, and with a self-assuredness I didn't know I had, I asked the bartender for another glass, this time with bubbles. Whether I felt it working or not, I'm convinced my 2 weeks of force positive self-talk helped me do something with confidence that my social anxiety would normally prohibit me from doing. So I consider that a damn good and bubbly start.
Dear Kristen and Jolenta, I've tried practicing positive self-talk, but every time I do, I feel like a liar. What's the point in saying nice things to myself if I don't believe what I'm saying? SH. Dear SH, believe us, we feel your pain. As Jolenta was just saying, she didn't used to believe the sunny affirmations she said to herself either. She still struggles too. And yet, positive self-talk still seemed to make a difference in her life. Before living by what to say when you talk to yourself, she felt unable to speak up when she was served flat Prosecco. After, she did. The point here, maybe she didn't have to consciously believe all the nice things she said to herself for those nice things to make a difference. Maybe she just had to let them wash over her like the sounds of advertisements on TV, songs on the radio, and all the other noises in the modern world that tell us what we should think about ourselves, even if we're not consciously listening. For me, the path to being kinder to myself was driven by my desire to be kinder to others. As is the case with a lot of girls in America, my childhood habit when complimented on my appearance was to reply with, "No, my skin looks horrible," or, "I can barely fit into this dress. I'm sure I look like a sausage." At one point, someone I admired said to me, "Will you please just say thank you when people compliment you? Every time you deny their compliments, you're essentially saying they're idiots with no power of observation." Another person I admired put it more bluntly, "You sound like you're fishing for more compliments every time you deny someone's kind words." I was mortified. Was I really coming off as such a jerk? I didn't mean to be. I was just trying to be honest. I really and truly believed I looked like a monster most of the time. But driven by my desire to be kinder to others, I began to accept compliments more graciously. Over time, that led to me internalizing what some of those complimentary words were saying. And it also led me to a realization. I never complimented myself. I talked to myself like I was the worst, ugliest, most unworthy person on the planet. I talked to myself as I would never talk to anyone else. And thank God for therapy and good friends for helping me to realize I could do better. My point, accepting compliments also felt like a lie to me in the beginning, but I did it to be kind to others, and that kindness to others eventually led to me being kinder to myself. I worked with the lie until it became the truth. And now I know what the real lie was. Practice gratitude. At least 10% of the books Jolenta and I have lived by have told us to practice gratitude, but the ways of and reasons for doing so have varied wildly. For example, when we were living by The Secret by Rhonda Byrne, gratitude was just one of many small steps we were advised to take in order to get what we wanted out of life, along with making vision boards, imagining our futures, and just outright telling the universe what we wanted. It was more or less a way of saying, "I'm the kind of person who appreciates what I have, so I should be given more." Personally, I found this version of thanks mercenary and icky. Other books treat gratitude quite differently. For example, when we were living by Marie Kondo's The Life-Changing Magic of Tidying Up, we were told to thank each item we owned for its service. In some cases, we thanked an item that was cluttering our home and that we no longer felt a connection to or needed. We'd say, "Physics textbook, thank you for helping me get through the final semester of college, but it's time you go to someone who can use you again." Alternatively, if something was an impulse buy that we never once used, we'd say, "Thank you, unicorn mini dress, for the thrill of buying you. I enjoyed that jolt of energy when I first laid eyes on you, but it's time you go to someone who will actually wear you." In addition to thanking items we discard, The Life-Changing Magic of Tidying Up recommends thanking items we keep. For example, the book suggests emptying out your handbag at the end of the day so that it can rest and thanking the bag for its service. I didn't enjoy emptying out my bag. Doing so led to wasting extra time every evening and morning on what I considered an unnecessary task. But I did enjoy thanking my bag, as well as my clothes and my bed and my apartment and all the other objects that helped me live the life I want. I loved coming home from work, kicking off my shoes and saying, "Thank you, shoes, for helping me to walk around this city I love." I loved taking off my glasses at night and saying, "Thank you for helping me to see the beauty in the world a bit more clearly." But my favorite approach to gratitude was in a book by John Kralik called A Simple Act of Gratitude. In a single year, Kralik set out to write 365 thank you notes. Initially, he did it as a way to feel less hopeless. When he embarked on his project, he wasn't sure his life was worth living. But with each letter he wrote and tracked, he was able to literally count his blessings. At the same time, the act of sitting down each day with pen and paper helped to retrain his brain to focus more on the good things in life and less on the bad. But Kralik didn't just write letters. He also made a practice of answering simple how are yous with things he was grateful for rather than complaints. When he was feeling down, he would play the glad game, which he first learned about while reading Eleanor H. Porter's classic children's book Pollyanna to his daughter. In the glad game, players list all the things they're happy about, not as a way of denying their pain, but as a way to muster the fortitude to get through life's challenges. I absolutely adored Living by Kralik's book. At the time we lived by it, the branch of the company I was working for had just decided to fold. I was worried about my direct reports and concerned for myself. And on top of that, I had medical issues that required surgery. I was feeling down. But writing thank you letters helped me to feel a bit better. I wrote a note to each person on my team who was let go, thanking them for all their hard work and for making my life happier. I wrote to my doctors, thanking them for their care and support. And I even wrote a letter to the boss who made the final decision to close my department, thanking him for all the opportunities he gave me over the years. These letters allowed me to focus on how fortunate I was, not just for good medical care and good opportunities, but for all the people in my life whom I was lucky enough to know and feel supported by. How much more horrible would my life have been had I been forced to face all my troubles alone? Writing thank you notes reminded me I wasn't alone, and I probably never would be. And I also have to point out that practicing gratitude is fun. It's so much more joyful than looking at all the ways life is imperfect or envying others who have more. It is a true joy to admire birds and be thankful we live in a world where animals can fly. It is a pleasure to tell my husband I appreciate all he does for me and feel the gratitude in my bones. And yes, to go back to Marie Kondo, the world feels a little more magical when I thank my shoes and glasses for all they do for me. Now, before I wrap this up, I feel it's only right for me to mention Jolenta's experience with gratitude here. While Jolenta had fun with gratitude, living by the secret, and still sings the praises of the life-changing magic of tidying up, she had mixed feelings about Kralik's book. Focusing on thanks every day reminded her of all she should be thankful for, but it also reminded her of the fact that she took a lot of things in her life for granted. Combined, those feelings made her wonder, "What's wrong with me? Why can't I just be thankful for what I have? This book makes me feel like a jerk." And a bigger criticism she had of Kralik's book was that it didn't focus more on giving back. As Jolenta sees it, thanking means you're receiving. But if you're receiving, shouldn't you also be giving? And while yes, Kralik raised thousands of dollars for charity and helped his direct reports and family by the end of his experiment, it's true that he didn't necessarily instruct his readers to do the same. All that being said, Jolenta will grudgingly admit that living by a simple act of gratitude made her happier. Thanks to the book, she reached out to people like her grandmother, to whom she hadn't talked in a while, and thanked them for being in her life. Those moments of thanks led to bigger conversations and feelings of connection, and when Jolenta and her husband Brad played the glad game, the shift from frustration to humor to tenderness between the two of them was palpable. In short, even a gratitude skeptic like Jolenta felt her life improved with a bit of thanks. And for a gratitude lover like me, being thankful each day made truly tough times more bearable. And for that, I'm thankful. Dear Kristen and Jolenta, you've demonstrated on your show and in other public arenas that you're both activists. How can you be so grateful and be activists at the same time? Doesn't one negate the other? Doesn't a relentless focus on gratitude mean you're turning a blind eye to climate change and racism and all the other issues you're actively trying to fight? There's so much not to be grateful for. NG. Dear NG, I honestly don't believe that being thankful makes me blind to the world's ugliness. Rather, I think it reminds me of what I'm fighting for. Those birds in the sky that I'm so thankful for, they're part of what I want to save. The access I have to outstanding health care and a decent education, I don't just selfishly appreciate them, I also want to fight for everyone else, regardless of race, economic background, gender, or sexual orientation, to have the same access I do. Also, gratitude gives me a break from despair. If all I did every minute of every day was lament the negative things in the world, I suspect I'd eventually stop getting out of bed. What fighting could I do then? And gratitude helps to sustain relationships, not just with those we already know and love, but with others who are trying to fight the good fight. We can't be in this alone. Telling people we value them and their contributions is the least we can do. Yes, I can be thankful, and I can be an activist. In fact, I can't see a way to do one without the other. Kristen.
Treat people as they want to be treated, not as you want to be treated. When I was only a few months into dating the dude I'd end up marrying, we had a fight that perplexed me to no end. Brad, that's his name, took me to brunch at a little place in his neighborhood. The food was great, the vibe was adorable, and I had a lovely meal. To show how much I was enjoying myself, I inhaled a plate of huevos rancheros, picked up the bill, and held his hand on the walk home. However, while we were walking back to his apartment, he had a meltdown. "Why didn't you like brunch?" he whined. "I loved brunch. What are you talking about?" I shot back. "You weren't excited enough," he replied, as he let go of my hand and huffily crossed his arms over his chest. This hurt my feelings. What in the world was he talking about? I wasn't excited enough? What did he want from me? Did he want me to jump up and down and be all girly about my big hero who'd found the perfect brunch spot? Did he want a medal? Did he want me to bow down to the patriarchy and be a completely different person who fawned over men who could pick restaurants? No, thank you. "You're crazy, dude. I don't know what you want from me. I liked my eggs, but I'm not going to throw you a parade about it," was my friendly reply. This last comment shut down the argument, and we finished our walk back to his place in silence. We got over this argument quickly, distracted by a movie his roommate was watching or something like that, but every once in a while, I'd think back to our little brunch exchange with outrage and wonder, what the hell was that about? Fast forward a few years to the second season of By the Book, when Kristen and I lived by a book that finally shed some light on the great brunch meltdown of 2011. That book was The Five Love Languages by Gary Chapman. In it, Chapman lays out his theory that there are five ways to express and experience love. These ways, or love languages, are receiving of gifts, quality time, words of affirmation, acts of service, and physical touch. Chapman believes all people have a primary and a secondary love language that are the easiest ways for them to experience love. Someone who likes touch might rub your feet to say, "I love you." Someone who loves acts of service might feel loved when you empty the dishwasher, and so on. Once you understand a person's love language, you can more easily make them feel loved. Feeling loved leads to better communication and overall happier relationships. As Kristen and I read that book, it became clear to me that Brad and I have total opposite love languages. His are quality time and words of affirmation. Mine are acts of service and physical touch. When I finished reading, that memory of brunch popped into my head, and it dawned on me then that we were each trying to express and receive love in a language the other didn't understand. I was trying to show my appreciation through service by picking up the bill and physical touch by holding hands. But since he doesn't speak those languages, my messages of love and gratitude were missed by him. He wanted me to express my feelings with words, in a love language he spoke fluently. When we live by the five love languages, Kristen and I learned way more about our spouses than we ever expected. She began to see that Dean's overly handsy nature was his way of trying to show he loved her, and she was able to tell him she didn't share that language but would work harder to show her affection through physical touch, which she did beautifully when she pushed him by his tushy up the stairs while he carried heavy boxes into their new apartment. And Dean took fewer liberties with his hands and found ways to better speak love languages that Kristen understands, like acts of service, as illustrated through the just-mentioned box carrying. I, on the other hand, learned that I hardly ever compliment my partner. I tease him and make him the butt of my jokes, and assume because I do chores and give great cuddles, he must feel loved by me. I was wrong. When we were living by the book, he admitted to me that when I tease him a ton, sometimes he truly wonders if I hate him. This was a wake-up call. I thought I was great at communicating my love to Brad, but because I wasn't speaking his language, my declarations of devotion masked as kisses, and my acts of service emptying the dishwasher weren't being received. He saw me pushing myself to try new things and working hard to use nice words, and he really felt loved. I think it helped us both get over our own insecurities and put our focus and efforts on each other. Offer gracious apologies. In 2016, my husband, Brad, lived on the road reporting on the election all over the country. We were newlyweds, and right when we said I do to each other, he also said I do to a fancy new reporting job. He spent our entire first year of marriage going to events with Hillary and Trump, and I spent our first year of marriage working at home, being pretty lonely. But all of that was going to change once we went to Argentina after the election. This was our big plan. We were going to reconnect while trekking through the wilds of Patagonia. While this may sound amazing to most of you, I'm going to be honest. I'm not a fan of trekking. I know I am lucky to have trekked enough to even know the fact that trekking isn't my favorite activity. I spent all my school years at a small school in Oregon that forced yearly backpacking, camping, and hiking treks starting at age 10, and I always associate trips like this with feeling like a kid being forced to do arbitrary activities against her will. Not a fan. Brad, on the other hand, is a huge fan of treks, adventures, wandering aimlessly, all of those cool, travel-y things. I love his curious, adventurous heart. I love it so much, I don't want to disappoint. So that's how I ended up lying to myself and him and agreeing that hiking across an iceberg and up many windswept cliffs in the pouring rain was a great way to come together with my beloved after a year apart. I basically ignored all the planning he was doing. I didn't want to know specifics about which activities I'd be dreading the most, so I simply pretended it wasn't really happening. But while we were on our flight, I figured it was time to face the music, and I finally asked about our itinerary in detail. I did not like what I heard. As Brad listed remote day-long hikes, insane weather, and the fact that we'd have to do all this with strangers in small groups, note, my least favorite thing next to trekking is being forced to do said trekking with small groups of strangers, I ended up having a huge meltdown. I cried for hours as we flew, feeling trapped between wanting to spend time with him and not actually wanting to go on an adventure. While I cried, I said mean things to Brad about how he ignores my needs, is selfish, is pushy, and doesn't appreciate me for who I am. These things were all kind of true, to be honest. We had really disconnected while he was away. But screaming this all at him while trapped in an airplane long after having agreed to go along with him on this trip was not helping my case, nor was it very nice. He apologized a lot for his part. We spent long nights staying up late talking. We talked all about how I felt our trip was a chance for intimacy that we were wasting on his outdoor adventure fantasies. He asked me all about how I felt overlooked during the year he spent away and overlooked as he planned activity after activity he knew I wouldn't want to do. He apologized for not considering my needs without being told. He admitted he knew he was planning things I wouldn't like and resented that I wasn't speaking up, so he kept planning more and more. He apologized, asked how he could make things up to me, and he started taking action right away. That night, he changed our itinerary for me so we'd spend more time in the city. And when we got back home, he found a couples therapist for us to start seeing so we could work together on our communication and he could work on showing his empathy for me. I can tell you, almost 3 years later, all of this work is paying off. We've never again gotten to a place as low as we were on that flight, which is funny because you'd think that you couldn't be hitting rock bottom in your marriage while flying in the air. But there was one thing wrong with how we move forward. I never really dealt with my part. That's right. I never apologized to Brad for berating him for hours, telling him he was inconsiderate, selfish, and incapable of thinking of me and my needs. I threatened divorce on that flight and called him many mean names, and I got away with it. From then on, anytime we had to travel, Brad and I would fight. Planning trips and holiday visits was a nightmare. I just figured we were bad at traveling and would be for the rest of our lives. But then Kristen and I were asked by the Science of Happiness podcast to be their happiness guinea pigs and learn how to give an effective apology. The Science of Happiness is a show that brings together science and stories about living a meaningful life. Based out of UC Berkeley and produced in tandem with the university's Greater Good Science Center, the show highlights the most provocative and practical scientific findings about compassion, gratitude, mindfulness, and awe. Kristen and I were asked to follow the guidelines laid out by the center on how to give a truly effective apology. After getting our assignment, I sat down with Brad and asked him if there was anything in our 10-year history that he felt was unresolved and could maybe use an apology. I assumed he wouldn't come up with anything and would tell me I was such a perfect wife, there was no way in hell he'd feel like there were any unresolved issues between us. I was wrong. It took him only a split second to say, "I mean, there's the way you handled Argentina. You said a lot of hurtful things on that flight, and I did a lot of work to learn from the mistakes I made back then, but you never really did." Oh no. He was right. He totally deserved an apology for how I acted. So I got to work using my new guidelines to craft the perfect "sorry about Argentina" speech. You'd think this would be a monumental undertaking, but it was surprisingly simple. All I had to do to make amends was acknowledge what I did wrong, explain the misguided intentions behind what I did, share my remorse by communicating what I regret doing and how I'll work to not do that in the future, and last, offer a way to repair the damage done. I followed the rules and apologized to Brad for misleading him by acting okay with everything until it was too late because I was afraid to disappoint him. I told him I could easily see how he must have felt like I lied to him by acting as if everything was fine until it was way too late. I promised to do better voicing my preferences in the future and offered to help plan our next trip so we wouldn't end up in the same predicament. When I finished telling Brad all these things, it was like I had put a magic spell on him. He was over the moon happy because he finally felt understood and reassured. And it didn't just end there. I followed through on my offer to be more involved in our travel, and we just went on a trip to Jamaica that was awesome for both of us, and no one had a meltdown on the flight. And what's great about apologies is you can make them no matter how big or small the issue is. They work with big hot-button issues and little everyday accidents. Kristen's happiness guinea pig apology is the perfect example of this. Is it me, or is Kristen the perfect example of most things? Kristen's apology was to her husband, Dean, for accidentally breaking his favorite kitchen tool. She used her effective apology to acknowledge how she'd be more careful in the future and offered to buy Dean a replacement. From little mistakes to divorce-threatening blowouts, being acknowledged and reassured helps alleviate the pain of those we hurt. And if we learned anything from why good things happen to good people, it is that putting positivity into the world and righting any wrongs we've left unresolved can only bring about more positive things in the future, or at least better vacations and unbroken kitchen gadgets.